Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Today, we begin the show by talking about the complex legacy of the Marquette and Joliet expedition. And we're learning more about a reenactment of the voyage in Prairie du Chien. Michael Douglas, one of our guests today, he was director of the Villa Louis Historical Society from 1983 to 2013, I believe. He was a seasonal park ranger at Effigy Mounds National Monument for 5 summers after retirement. Michael has lived in Prairie du Chien for 40 years. Michael, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Larry. I'm delighted to be here.
Also with us today, pleased to have Margaret Hiddle with us. She's Director of Indigenous Studies and an Assistant Professor of History at UW Oshkosh. Margaret is of Lakota Ojibwa descent. And Margaret, thank you for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show today.
So as we talk with our experts today, I hope you'll join in. Are you curious about how the Marquette-Joliet expedition might have impacted your community long ago? Tell us what you think about historical reenactments. I'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Michael, let's start with you. Take us back to the late 1600s and kind of set the scene for us. Who were Marquette and Joliet?
Well, they were two people from New France, and things had been challenging for the government of New France in the 1600s. They had arrived here in the early 1600s under the doctrine of discovery, which gave them their own sense of legal right to claim lands occupied by Native people, and also to begin spreading colonies. And the industry of the 17th century was the fur trade. But the government of France also felt a moral commitment to spreading the good news of the Christian church. So they also brought missionaries. So we see the efforts in New France in the 1600s of taking the fur trade taking root and also of the Catholic Church taking root. There were challenges. The French allied themselves with the Huron. The Huron were ancient enemies of the Haudenosaunee. And the Hurons suffered terrible losses to epidemics. They suffered losses due to war from the Haudenosaunee. And we see the Huron moving across the upper Great Lakes and into Wisconsin in the late 1600s with the French missionaries following them. We also see the Hudson's Bay Company being founded in 1670. And a major event in 1671 is, again, using the doctrine of discovery, the government of New France claims all of the waters touched by the Great Lakes for the King of France. And with this assumed legal authority, they began a notion of really discovering what this meant. And that comes forth in the spring of 1673 when Father Marquette, a Jesuit-trained Jesuit missionary, and Louis Joliet, a cartographer, both highly gifted individuals, come together and mount an expedition with 5 others and 2 canoes, and they come to La Baie to De Pere, make their way up the Fox River and down to the Mississippi River, arriving on June 17th, 1673.
Yeah.
A whole bunch of stuff we can talk about there.
Yeah, lots to talk about. And Margaret, Marquette and Joliet passed through present-day Oshkosh, where you are right now, and that was near the start of the journey. Maybe give us an idea or more of an idea of the Native American tribes who were already present along the route they traveled.
Yeah, so the place where I live and work today, Oshkosh, which is named after a Menominee leader, Chief Oshkosh, is the past, present, and future homelands of the Menominee Nation, as well as the Ho-Chunk Nation here in Wisconsin. And both the Ho-Chunk and Menominee still call Wisconsin and this place home to this day. It's also, you know, it's also in the larger network of Indigenous nations, including the Ojibwe, other Anishinaabeg peoples like the Odawa and the Potawatomi, and, you know, some Meskwaki people who had been pushed further west by the fur trade conflict that that Michael was talking about, and this area where Marquette and Joliet traveled through and supposedly, you know, were quote unquote discovering places, was part of a thriving network of Indigenous economies, politics, and social communities.
I was interested in that part of it. Maybe you could talk more about what life was like for those tribes before, or maybe expand on what life was like before the arrival of the European explorers.
Yeah, so a lot of times when we hear early Indigenous people talked about, they get described as hunter-gatherers, which, you know, gives this sense of people just kind of wandering around what is currently Wisconsin. But the reality is that nations like the Menominee had really long, really deep connections and purposeful connections with place and the resources in the place. So the Menominee Nation, their name comes from it means the wild rice people, right? So wild rice was an incredibly important resource to the Menominee Nation. In his journals, Marquette actually describes the process of harvesting wild rice in this area. They hunted, they planted gardens and grew a variety of vegetables that kept themselves and their families fed. They also practiced leisure activities. They made music, they danced, they did all of the things that people like to do that make us people, just, you know, in different ways. And the same is true for the Ho-Chunk. The Ho-Chunk were farmers. They grew corn, in particular. Corn was incredibly important to the Ho-Chunk people and continues to be this day. You know, the Ho-Chunk people spent a lot of time harvesting, planting corn. You know, one of the things about Indigenous life, both before and after the arrival of Europeans, is how important these waterways were. So waterways connected people to each other across vast different distances. So Indigenous people weren't isolated.
Sure.
They communicated and traded with people across very vast distances.
So what were the interactions like then, Margaret, between the Native American tribes and the French explorers?
So one way to put it is that the French were very dependent on Indigenous people. When it differs, obviously, each specific place and each specific encounter. When the Menominee, for instance, first met with Marquette and Joliet, right? These weren't the first Europeans that they had encountered. They had a much longer history of encounters with Europeans. Nicolet had come to the Green Bay area earlier in the 17th century, and they also would have heard about relationships with Europeans from other Indigenous nations and interacted through the broader network of the fur trade that was, you know, taking place across the North American continent at that point in time. And so what the Menominee did when Marquette and Joliet arrived was give them advice, right? They said, you know, you should probably know that there's a lot of conflict in the area that you're headed, and you might encounter some, you might find yourself in the middle of conflict between Indigenous nations. The river is very dangerous and it's really hot. So that was their response. Further west, you know, all of the knowledge that Marquette and Joliet were going on was Indigenous knowledge. The map that they had with them came from Indigenous people like from Marquette's conversations with Indigenous people at the mission where he was at before before this journey. And it was Indigenous people who helped them find the portage from the Fox River to the Wisconsin River. And that continues to be true all the way along, right? Even their canoes, their birch bark canoes, were stocked with what Marquette calls Indian corn and smoked meat, right? Like, it's Native people who fed them on the journey. And so in many ways, the journey wouldn't have been possible without the labor of Indigenous people and without good relationships with Indigenous people.
So what role then, I guess it's a direct role, but what role did Marquette and Joliet play in the eventual removal of Native American people from their land?
They were part of the French enterprise. They literally and figuratively made the map from Montreal to the Mississippi River. This map, if you will, provided a knowledge base and a literal passage for additional people, primarily Francophones, to come with the fur trade and with evangelism. So they played a role that probably would have happened eventually anyway, because these were the kind of the forces of the time. But they were the first to really articulate this. Marquette sort of exemplifies the perfect missionary, kind, listening, observant, maybe even too much of a perfect missionary. They were met with kindness, as Margaret described. They were met with good advice. They were met with help. They were met with support. It was a remarkably the expedition was remarkable in that it was easier than one can imagine. But it did begin what would end in tragedy.
Got some emails. Well, Matt in Madison wonders if Marquette kept a diary, and he did he keep a pretty detailed diary, Margaret?
Yeah, so he kept a diary. It's available. You can find it. Like, if you Google it, you can pull it up on various open source information. I think the Wisconsin Historical Society has a translated version of it. Joliet actually kept the more detailed records of the trip, but when he was returning to Michilimackinac a few years later, he had it with him in his canoe. The canoe capsized. He was the only survivor, and he lost his those written records along the way as well. So a tragedy for a historian like me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Talking today with Michael Douglas, a Prairie du Chien historian, and Margaret Hiddle, Director of Indigenous Studies and an Assistant Professor of History at UW Oshkosh, taking a look at the complex history of the Marquette and Joliet expedition. We'll also get to talk about the reenactment that is going to be taking place, the Prairie du Chien reenactment, with our guests. You can join in, too. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You could email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Clara Neipert's our producer today. A. Emily Ralph, our engineer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the Marquette and Joliet expedition and its complex history with our two guests today, Michael Douglas and Margaret Hiddle. Great to have both of them with us. And again, you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. You could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Jed in Lakota Ray Reserve has a question for us or comment. Hi, Jed. Thank you for calling.
Bonjour, bonjour, miigwech, miigwech. I'm in to all relations, all directions. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the French language and the Ojibwe Mohan language I'm calling from Couderay, which in my ignorance, I originally thought was Court of Kings, and then someone told me about cut ear or whatever. I don't even know, but it's a French word. And out here, we call it Lake of the Odawa, Odawa Zawagining. So I'm just wondering if we can kind of do away with the French misnomer, so maybe bring back the Ojibwa names, like Lac de Flambeau comes to mind, and Fond-du-Lac. Like, respect the French, but I don't even know what the, you know, why we adopted the French names. And clearly, I'm not a fan of evangelicization or misnomers.
Yeah.
We don't need to be saved or evangelized. We kind of just need to be left alone at peace. You know what I mean?
Well, we can get comments from both of our guests maybe on that. Margaret Hiddle, do you want to start?
Yeah. So renaming places is part of the process of colonization and claiming those places for the French, for the British, right? There's power in names, and erasing the indigenous names, replacing them, is an incredibly important part of that power in writing French Empire into existence. You know, I was thinking about the Fox River where I live, which, right, we can all name the Fox River. We know the Fox River. But do we know the Menominee name for the Fox River, which I'm going to butcher this, and I apologize to all Menominee people out there, but the Menominee name for the Fox River is Meskwaku Sepia, and the Ho-Chunk name for the Fox River, and again, my apologies for mispronouncing this, is Neonagera. And the Menominee name refers to the red earth around the river, right? And the you know, it contains knowledge about what kind of soil this is, about what kind of place this is to live. And so in the process of renaming, we lose that knowledge. And so I completely agree, right? Recovering the indigenous place names is a really important part about learning to live in the place where we all are today, the place that we call Wisconsin.
Yeah. Michael, anything you want to add, jump in on?
Well, I think that the difficulty of native names was often a problem for these early Europeans who couldn't get their tongues around some of these names. We do have names like Shawamagon. We do have names that they thought they heard and then mispronounced, and their mispronunciations kind of got locked into history. We see the Mississippi River, sometimes coined as the Mississippi River, Mississippi, various versions of this. And I think that it reflects in part what these early explorers were thought they heard. It wasn't always the case, I think, of running roughshod over native traditions. There's challenges there. They tried to be ethnographic. But they were just seeing things through such a very specific set of eyes and hearing things through such a specific set of ears that they often clearly didn't get it right.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's take a call from Dot in Manitowoc next. Hi, Dot. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good morning. I'm wondering why they call indigenous the name indigenous. Why don't they call them American Indians? And actually, what does indigenous mean?
Okay. Margaret, turn to you.
Yeah, so this is another issue of slippery language, right? And the way that language changes over time. American Indian, or just Indian, Native American, and Indigenous are all essentially terms for the same thing. I'm going to go with Columbus. Before Columbus arrived, right, this place that we call North America, the United States today, was home to literally hundreds, probably thousands of different Indigenous nations who didn't see themselves as connected under an umbrella term. It's this history of colonization and the history of Europeans coming in and viewing Native people as essentially the same. I mean, just like the term European, right? We know French, British, German, etc. are all different nations. But that umbrella term came after the fact. And most, you will find Native people who prefer to be called Indian today. You will find Native people who like Native or Indigenous better. Indigenous is a slightly broader term that refers to, could include Indigenous people from, for instance, from Norway, the Sami people. It includes Indigenous people from South America as well. And it isn't dependent on that relationship with America. And that's why some people prefer it. I personally use a mix of Indigenous and Native American. You'll never get the same answer from Indigenous people about what term they prefer.
Hmm. Dot, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Michael, what did the expedition accomplish overall for the French?
It was a big deal for the French. It was important in its day as the Lewis and Clark expedition was to the young United States, and even the Apollo 11's landing in the 20th century. It was the first time non-Native people explored central portions of the Mississippi. They were the first to determine for European map makers the courses of the river that ran through the interior, the Missouri, the Ohio, the Des Moines, the Illinois, the Arkansas. It determined that the Mississippi emptied into the Gulf of Mexico. It determined that the Ohio River was not the Mississippi. It was the first attempt to try to understand the geography of the Mississippi Valley. And it served as the impetus for the later French occupation of the Illinois country. It set a standard for peaceful diplomacy. It advanced the prospects of both the fur trade and the evangelization of Native people, but also it was the first to seriously introduce vehicles of conquest.
Yeah.
So a big deal for people of French heritage, a big deal for New France, not so good for the indigenous people of the upper Midwest.
Yeah. And Margaret, a term we hear often is settler colonialism. You want to talk about the meaning of that and kind of in relation to what we're discussing here?
Yeah, so settler colonialism is one of many kinds of colonialism. And the idea with settler colonialism is that the colonizing power, it is a system of colonialism where the colonizing power brings in their own people, right? Brings in people to settle in a place, hence the settler colonialism, and not just to settle and live with the indigenous population, not just to settle with and even exploit the labor and resources of the indigenous population, but settler colonialism is a system that ultimately intends to replace and erase the indigenous population. And that can be done either through outright violence and violent genocide. And it can also be done through quieter forms of violence like assimilation or converting indigenous people into into Euro-American culture. So things like boarding schools, for instance, right, which come from this long legacy of Catholic missionaries in the United States, and then also the United States' goals of removing future generations of indigenous people without having to resort to actual violence. These boarding schools were intended to indoctrinate indigenous children into American culture, American Christian religion, and make so there would not be future generations of children growing up as indigenous. So settler colonialism then is this system that continues to this day in which a colonizing power replaces an indigenous population.
And so the spread of Catholicism, Michael mentioned earlier the issue. It apparently impacted Native American tribes pretty heavily, from what you're saying there, Margaret.
Yes, and it's not just Catholicism. It's many different branches of Christian faiths that were sponsored by the U.S. government to be part of their policy to get lands and resources from Indigenous people. And this was explicit. This was explicit U.S. policy in starting in the late 19th century. So it's complicated, and it's not, you know, many of the people who engaged in things like missionary activities and boarding schools genuinely wanted to do what was best, what they thought was best for Indigenous people. They came in, I hope, with good intentions, but the impacts that they, the impacts that they had on Indigenous communities is, you know, a legacy of more than 350 years of harm.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that makes it difficult. But I mean, you look at the Jesuits in the 17th century, and they had this notion of companionship. I mean, they had this notion of from their founder that really said we must enter through their door so that they will exit through ours. But I think that many of the intentions, at least of the early Jesuits, were rather benign. No doubt whatsoever where the road ended. But in these very beginning days, we see the Jesuits ministering to displaced Native people, the Huron, who had been relocated all the way out to Shawamigan Bay. We see them really ministering in some pretty genuine and pretty moving ways. So it just is part of the complexity of the story.
Yeah.
Right. And there are Indigenous people today who identify as Catholic. There are Indigenous people today who are a variety of Christian faiths. It is incredibly complicated, and it's incredibly personal as well.
Yeah. So I want to switch, and I've got Mike and Manakwa coming up with a question, but let's talk about the fur trade, Michael, because something I mentioned at the beginning, we almost lost all the furry mammal population we had in the, and I'm wondering, the French fur traders really affected that.
Well, they did. They had an insatiable appetite for beaver furs. It was determined very early on, way back in the 11, 1200s, that beaver fur, the underbelly, the wool of the beaver pelt, was the best fiber in the world for making felt for beaver hats. And they had all but trapped the beaver to extinction in Europe. So in the earliest days of contact along the St. Lawrence River, when they saw Native people, Algonquin Natives, wearing these robes made from beaver furs, they saw a resource of great value. And they pursued beaver pelts all across the nation, and truly did decimate the population. Other furs were collected as well, but it was that desire for beaver pelts that really really led for the aggressive fur trade across the Great Lakes. So, yes.
Well, let's take a call from Mike in Manakwa. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, Larry, I mean, I don't think anyone can answer my questions, but I just had a thought process that if we had had the power to somehow prevent industrialized nations, quote unquote, from coming to this hemisphere ever, and so none of the technological advancements that they brought, for better or for worse, would have ever come here, how would we have done that? How could that have been possibly done, number one? And then secondly, if we had been successful in doing that for some reason, wanting to do it and been successful, what would the Native people have done with this hemisphere, particularly North America, and what would it look like today, these hundreds of years later, without European influence?
Interesting questions. And Margaret, have you thought about that, or are you thinking about it now?
Yeah, it is, you know, an impossible and yet very interesting question. I'm a historian, so counterfactuals kind of inherently make me a little uncomfortable. But there are so many Indigenous writers and artists who are thinking about these questions. There is this there's a Dungeons and Dragons type game called Coyote and Crow by Indigenous game makers that kind of plays with this idea of what it could look like if colonization had never happened in North America. There are other, you know, there are lots of other authors who think about what this continent could look like in different configurations of power. If you look up Indigenous futurisms, there's just so many examples. And then the other question is, I think there's other ways that we could think about this question, like what would happen if the United States simply honored the treaties that it agreed to with Native nations, right? It doesn't have to be an all or nothing. What would we can imagine other situations like along a sliding scale of interaction? What would happen if instead of trying to take over Indigenous lands, Europeans had agreed to share Indigenous lands and resources? And is that a question that is a foregone conclusion in the past, or is it an actual possibility for our future? Is there a future in which we, living in Wisconsin, living in the United States, could imagine sharing lands and resources together and building a future that works for everybody and everybody, including our non-human relatives that live in this place as well?
Yeah, interesting. Michael, I we're getting closer to the end of the time here, and I know you are, the city of Prairie du Chien, I should say, is planning to observe the anniversary of the expedition. Would you tell us about that?
I'm delighted to. We are trying to avoid lifting this up as celebration, more as observance. And it's really at the center of this event is our 50-year-old fur trade rendezvous and flea market that has been going on forever, celebrating the Rocky Mountain fur trade. And this year, the dates of that event happen to coincide with the anniversary of the Marquette and Joliet expedition. So a whole bunch of community leaders and organizations have combined to produce a festival weekend that tries to braid together history, the river, and the remarkable beauty of the Driftless region. So we are planning Native American dance exhibitions. We have an 18th century French voyageur encampment, flint napping exhibits, canoe rides on the river, horse-drawn carriage rides, an art fair at the courthouse, axe throwing, all kinds of kids' hands-on games and activities, plus our beautiful Wyalusing, Pikes Peak, and Effigy Mounds National Monument. And kind of speaking about that last question of just firing imagination, to walk the trails of Effigy Mounds and to stand at Fire Point and look at the Mississippi River and imagine what this world was, imagine this upper Mississippi River when Marquette and Joliet first arrived 350 years ago, is inspiring and moving and beautiful.
And you have is there a reenactment? I mean, are people canoeing down the...
We have been working with a group that we think is coming. It's been, Marquette and Joliet were never really in Prairie du Chien. They got to the river and turned left. But there has been a group that's been working on putting an expedition together. And we are waiting with bated breath to see exactly who might arrive. We hope if and when they do, it's going to be with some cultural sensitivity. So we'll see. More to be had on that question.
I'm wondering, and by the way, that observance is June 16th through the 18th, right? With the festival, you know, the all of what you
That's
described.
That's the festival weekend, yes.
That's the festival weekend, the 16th through the 18th. Margaret, are you going to go to that?
I am not planning to go to that, but only because the city of Oshkosh is dedicating new plaques to the Chief Oshkosh statue here in town. So I have to. I am excited to be here to see that that observation.
I dropped my daughter off in Oshkosh yesterday. She's going to be doing some work with the DNR, and so. I crossed the Fox River, not with a canoe, yes, but in my car over the bridge. Oh, my goodness. So just so you think about it, are we thinking about, if you're a historian, how has the view of that expedition changed over 50 years, let's say?
Well, a lot has changed. We celebrated this 50 years ago. We celebrated it 100 years ago. There was no recognition or consideration of Native voices or consequences. It was all good. The doctrine of discovery was alive and well. In fact, it was just repudiated this very year, 350 years after Marquette and Joliet, the Vatican finally said they were wrong in promulgating the doctrine of discovery. So we look at the primary document, Marquette's journal with new eyes. We look at him and his fascination with the centrality of the sacred pipe. We look at his fascination with things like the tradition of the burdash, of Native men who dressed as women and who took on the roles of women. We look with new eyes today, and hopefully we look and listen with greater sensitivity. So things have changed.
Well, and I would just add, too, that Indigenous people have been telling these stories for the entirety of the last 350 years, right? That's the thing about history, is there's so many different versions of stories, and it does depend on who. It's important to include the fullest number of perspectives as possible, and these stories from Indigenous perspectives are not new. They are simply finally room being made for them in the dominant narrative, right? And if we are going to claim Marquette and Joliet as part of our shared origin story, and the we here is Wisconsin, right? The Wisconsin community, we have to claim and acknowledge that full story, which includes Indigenous people and includes a very complicated 350 years of dispossession and survival.
Well, this has been fascinating for me, and I hope for our listeners as well. And I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much, and hopefully we'll have a chance to do it again. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Larry.
Michael Douglas is the Prairie du Chien historian, or a Prairie du Chien historian. Margaret Hiddle is director of Indigenous Studies and an assistant professor of history at the UW Oshkosh. Great hearing from them. And coming up, we're going to take a look at one of our state's famous historic sites, Villa Louis. That next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.